The Consolations of Philosophy, written and read by Alain de Botton. For years, philosophy had seemed to me like an ultimate authority on life's great questions, a natural place to seek answers to the riddles of human unhappiness. It promised something at once a bit naive and yet rather profound, a way to change one's life for the better, to become a somewhat less disturbed, paranoid, inadequate, lovesick, and panicked individual. Philosophy is, of course, a vast subject. Many of its practitioners are entirely unconcerned with making one feel happier. But it nevertheless seemed possible to me to discern a small group of men, separated by centuries, who shared a loose allegiance to a single vision of philosophy, suggested by the Greek etymology of the word, philo, love, sophia, wisdom. A group of philosophers with a common interest in saying a few consoling and practical things about the cause of our greatest griefs. It was to these men I chose to turn. Hence a book in which I paired six philosophers, Socrates, Epicurus, Seneca, Montaigne, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche, with six everyday problems to which I felt they'd been able to give the most helpful and the most fascinating answers. The first philosopher to whom I turned was Socrates, who offered consolation for unpopularity. A few years ago, during a bitter New York winter, with an afternoon to spare before catching a flight to London, I found myself in a deserted gallery on the upper level of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It was brightly lit, and aside from the soothing hum of an underfloor heating system, entirely silent. Having reached a surfeit of paintings in the Impressionist galleries, I was looking for a sign for the cafeteria, where I hoped to buy a glass of a certain variety of American chocolate milk, of which I was at that time extremely fond, when my eye was caught by a canvas, which a caption explained had been painted in Paris in the autumn of 1786 by the 38-year-old Jacques-Louis David. The painting was called The Death of Socrates. Socrates, condemned to death by the people of Athens, prepares to drink a cup of hemlock, surrounded by woebegone friends. In the spring of 399 BC, three Athenian citizens had brought legal proceedings against the philosopher. They had accused him of failing to worship the city's gods, of introducing religious novelties, and of corrupting the young men of Athens. And such was the severity of their charges that they had called for the death penalty. Socrates had responded with legendary equanimity. Though afforded an opportunity to renounce his philosophy in court, he had sided with what he believed to be true rather than what he knew would be popular. In Plato's account, he had defiantly told the jury, "So long as I have breath and have my faculties, I shall never stop practicing philosophy and exhorting you and elucidating the truth for everyone that I meet. And so, gentlemen, whether you acquit me or not, you know that I'm not going to alter my conduct, not even if I have to die 100 deaths." And so Socrates had been led to meet his end in an Athenian jail, his death marking a defining moment in the history of philosophy. I bought a postcard of this David painting in the museum gift shop, and later, flying over the ice fields of Newfoundland, turned a luminous green by a full moon and a cloudless sky, examined one while picking at a pale evening meal left on the table in front of me by a stewardess during a misjudged snooze. Plato sits at the foot of the bed, a pen and a scroll beside him, silent witness to the injustice of the state. He'd been 29 at the time of Socrates' death, but David turned him into an old man, grey-haired and grave. Through the passageway, Socrates' wife is escorted from the prison cell by warders. Seven friends are in various stages of lamentation. Socrates' closest companion, Crito, seated beside him, gazes at the master with devotion and concern. But the philosopher, bolt upright, with an athlete's torso and biceps, shows neither apprehension nor regret. That a large number of Athenians have denounced him as foolish has not shaken him in his convictions. If this postcard struck me so forcefully, it was, perhaps, because the behaviour it depicted contrasted so sharply with my own. In conversations, my priority was always to be liked rather than to speak the truth. A desire to please led me to laugh at modest jokes like a parent on the opening night of a school play. With strangers, I adopted the servile manner of a concierge greeting wealthy clients in a hotel, salival enthusiasm born of a morbid, indiscriminate desire for affection. I didn't publicly doubt ideas to which the majority was committed. I sought the approval of figures of authority,